My name is Jonathan Ball, and I guess a variety of things. I'm a sessional instructor in Winnipeg teaching literature, film, and creative writing. I actually do primarily experimental poetry and fiction. So I've got a number of kind of experimental poetry books out. This Crowley book is my fourth book. My three other books are all, you know, creative writing. I've done a book of sort of a science fiction novel with no plot or characters called Ex Machina. I did a book of plays that are impossible to produce called Clockfire. I did a book about language and film and violence, but they're all, you know, poems, like a poem about the movie Psycho, as if watched by a psychotic Bates-like, you know, spectator. And then Crime Wave is, the John Pieces Crime Wave is my fourth book, but my first, academic book. So I do a sort of variety of things, but that's the sort of core thing that I've been engaged in, doing these sort of books about or just engaging in kind of experimental artistic practice.
Looking around on your website, I saw something that really caught my eye, which was called Why Poetry Sucks.
That's what I'm doing right now. Is I'm putting out two books this year. The Pays book is the one that, you know, is out now already, and then coming out shortly is a anthology that I'm co-editing, which is that Why Poetry Sucks. So it's a kind of a cheeky title for an anthology of experimental, kind of humorous experimental poetry, either experimental poetry that's, you know, funny, or that is just engaging with some humorous techniques. So, and it's all sort of Canadian poetry. It's Canadian experimental poetry anthology, but it's kind of organized around this trope of humor. Since there's this perception that experimental poetry or experimental art is not funny, I just kind of wanted to work against that a little bit. So me and my co-editor, a guy named Ryan Fitzpatrick, are putting that together. So that's, you know, we're just kind of proofing it. I was actually working earlier today just looking at the proofs, and it's going to be out very quickly. So it's been a busy kind of year because I've got both these books coming out. But yeah, that's the thing that's not quite out, but, you know, very, very shortly will be unleashed upon the world. So it's been a busy year so far.
Now, are you a Winnipeg native?
Not really, but, you know, I've spent probably most of my time here. Like, I grew up in small town Ontario, and I moved to Winnipeg just before going to university. I did 2 degrees here, English and film undergraduate, and then a English master's degree with a sort of film-ish thesis. And then I went to Calgary for 4 years to do a PhD in English literature and creative writing. And then I came back, and I sort of specialized in Canadian literature and film again, with a kind of more experimental bent. And then I came back to Winnipeg, after getting my PhD. And again, like I said, I've been kind of working as a sessional instructor, which is sort of like, you know, an adjunct professor in the States there. So yeah, so I've been here, you know, most of the time, most of my adult life, but not technically, you know, kind of a native of here. So I'm kind of, you know, I came here around 98, you know, quite late compared to, you know, when Pays was doing stuff, or the kind of, but the Winnipeg Film Group, of course, is still very active and in kind of a new boom. So I was kind of on the wave of the people who were very influenced by these filmmakers from the 80s, like Madden and Pays. So I got to kind of know, when Pays was already gone, but I got to kind of know Madden. George Toles is my thesis advisor in my master's degree. You know, that's kind of how I got introduced to that whole realm, was more or less through George.
Now, I know there are other Canadian filmmakers than the guys that are from Winnipeg, obviously, mm-hmm. you know, and even looking across the gamut today, as far as major Canadian filmmakers that are presently working, you know, Adam McGuane has new things out. David Cronenberg is working on things. There are, of course, a lot of other directors that I'm not mentioning. But what do you think that it is about Winnipeg in particular that had that kind of core group of, like, the Klimkue, Toles, Madden, Pays, like this group of guys that were all kind of cross-pollinating in the early 80s to kind of branch out and become these better-known directors?
You know, it's a really good question, and I think a part of the answer is just the Winnipeg Film Group itself. Just for whatever reason, that has been a real flashpoint for, you know, creative people interested in filmmaking in this city, certainly. But the other thing, there's a couple other, so just it has been a sort of lightning rod for talent in that way in a while. But the other thing that I think, there's sort of two other things I think are kind of unique or different about Winnipeg that I know, I think gesture towards an answer to that question. And one is just the fact that Winnipeg, although it's, you know, a large city, it's still in many ways a kind of a, it has a sort of feel of a small town in certain regards. It's very sort of interconnected. You know, people know one another. And there's a lot of sort of stumbling across. Like, everyone sort of has a friend of a friend connection within the city. And one of the sort of effects of that creatively has been that, unlike other places I've lived or visited, the different arts groups are really intermingled. Like, the musicians know the filmmakers know the video artists know the writers, you know. Those people really talk to one another and do stuff together. And even just where the film group is located in Winnipeg is right across the hall from it is, you know, a video arts collective. Right on the floor above it in the same building is the two literary journals, you know. There's all sorts of sort of just ways that the different arts disciplines have overlapped. So I think you get a lot of kind of cross discipline creativity and, you know, people working together on things, which I haven't really seen as exclusively or as extensively, I should say, in other places. The other thing I think is just kind of unique or odd about Winnipeg, just relative to, say, Toronto or Vancouver, like these larger filmmaking centers, is that in Winnipeg you have this, this weird hopelessness. You know, there's a sense that you can't succeed here. Like, while not precisely true, I think that's sort of like this weird hopelessness in the water. And what I've noticed is that people, the stakes seem to be very low in Winnipeg because success seems so far away that people tend to just experiment more. And they tend, I think, generally speak, my perception of it at least, is that people feel less pressure to succeed and so just do whatever they kind of are interested in doing rather than trying to chase some illusory market. And, you know, I think that that in some way has been a useful thing for Winnipeg. And I certainly know that guys like Madden and Klimkew also, you know, almost kind of took up the invisibility of Winnipeg in the cultural landscape as a challenge. And so I think there's a sort of a combination of different things that, you know, have kind of made Winnipeg a place that weirdly has been almost overrepresented in terms of, yeah, the kind of art and that people have come out of it.
I imagine it's safe to say that when you were growing up, you were a pretty big film fan.
Yeah, I've always had this kind of weird film interest, although, you know, I primarily have come at that. I mean, I've directed a couple of short films. I directed a short silent comedy called Spoonie B about a sort of 70s pimp in a silent film, you know, the look and feel of a sort of silent, almost a film that had been lost to history that nobody bothered to preserve, that kind of, you know, did with some hand processing and sitting and stuff. But mostly I've been, you know, worked in film as a screenwriter just, again, kind of working as a writer, generally speaking. So I kind of come at film, I guess, say, yeah, more of as a scholar and a fan, a little bit from the kind of writing perspective. But yeah, I don't know, I've just always been fascinated by, yeah, just film and literature, primarily those two things. And I also, like I say, was very lucky in my undergraduate and then and also my master's degree to kind of hook up with George Toles and get very friendly with him. He kind of was teaching classes literally called Film and Literature, where you would, you know, read books and watch the films that were made out of the books, or watch films and read books that were kind of thematically or artistically kind of related or that he felt were related somehow. So he was a huge influence on me in terms of, again, just, you know, being interested in certain types of films or getting exposed to things.
Was he the gateway then to kind of the world of the Winnipeg filmmakers?
In many respects, yeah. Because he and Steve Snyder, who was still teaching there at the time, he's since no longer teaching at the University of Manitoba, but although George still is. But those two were really big gateways, as you say, just because they were showing films, you know. And, of course, I was one of those people who, when I took a class somebody, I would go and find all the stuff they wrote and read all their books and, you know, whatever. And so with George, I got I mean, of course, I read his book when it came out, and I, you know, realized that he'd been writing his films. I took a screenwriting class with George, and so I got very interested very quickly in Guy Maddin's stuff. I actually, at one point, this is kind of a funny story. At one point, I was taking this class of George's, and kind of, I hadn't watched any Guy Maddin films, but I was kind of interested in his stuff. And I saw there was a Guy Maddin, like, little mini film festival going on at, you know, the Cinematheque. And so there was this girl in this class that I, you know, thought was kind of cute, and I was talking to her a little bit. I'm like, oh, she likes film, you know, maybe I'll ask her to this film, you know, Guy Maddin film thing. So I kind of get to talking to her, and I'm, you know, asking, kind of like broach, you know, coolly, I think, hey, you want to go check out these Guy Maddin films with me? And she just kind of recoils from the idea. And she's like, oh, Guy Maddin's films. Why do I want to go watch those again? And what I learned later is that she was actually dating Guy Maddin at the time.
Oh.
I had to ask Guy Maddin's girlfriend out to his own film festival, not having a clue, of course, you know, what was going on. But then, you know, later on, I got to meet Guy and became kind of friendly with him. But it was kind of a weird, you know, scenario. That was my weird sort of, you know, awkward gateway in, I guess.
So why John Pace's Crime Wave? Why focus an entire book on John Pace's Crime Wave?
You know, there's a lot of kind of weird reasons for it, I guess. One was just, I was doing volunteer work for the Winnipeg Film Group because I wanted, you know, access to cameras and stuff. Like I say, I was kind of learning to do hand processing and starting to do a bit of writing and directing and working on people's films around town as I was doing these degrees as well. And I basically had, you know, heard of the film, of course, by that point, but I hadn't seen it. And I'd seen some of Springtime in Greenland, some showing somewhere, and I was just fascinated with that film. So I volunteered to do distribution work for the film group, where my job was to make copies of the films, make screeners, so they could mail the VHS screeners out. So I basically, you know, made copies of these John Pace films for myself to take home, and basically stole a copy of Crime Wave. You know, there were some VHS copies from its kind of VHS release that I got at one point in the States, and then some just other VHS screeners. So I kind of, you know, snuck one home and watched it, and I was just amazed by this thing. I was just fascinated by it. I thought it was so funny. But even more than that, I felt like there were these always weird moments where he seemed to have this, just this control over the tone, and it was able to sort of shift the tone on a dime. Like, the moment that really cinched that my love of the film was that part where Stephen Penny is, you know, it's in the sort of final beginning and ending to Crime Wave, and Stephen Penny is remembered as sort of narrating, or it's being narrated, the story of Stephen Penny's youth, and sort of how every time the TV turns off, he hears this sort of monstrous sounds. And that's sort of a sudden shift from, like, the kind of blaring, bombastic music to, like, and the sudden, you know, almost kind of technicolor tones to, you know, he turns the TV off, and all the lights go dark, and it goes completely silent. That just sudden, like, spin on a dime shift in tone to me was just fascinating. And I'd only ever seen that sort of command and suddenness in terms of, you know, altering the atmosphere in Lynch films. And just really, really got to me. And so I started kind of watching it obsessively almost at that point. But then later on, the sort of story of how that I ended up reading a book on it, is I kind of realized accidentally that I had become the world's authority on Crime Wave, almost accidentally. I'd become one of the authorities on Crime Wave because I end up doing a conference paper on it. And then I also was interviewed about it because I'd done this conference paper. I was interviewed about basically, you know, why, what I thought of the film for a kind of documentary that was being made by Bravo TV on Crime Wave. And since I'd done those two things, John Pace started contacting me saying, like, hey, do you know anybody who could maybe help me try to, could you help me look at these marketing materials? Maybe I can try to do this on DVD or whatever. So I kind of like weirdly and accidentally, just because I was one of the only people doing anything with this film still. You know, most of the work on it had been done, you know, much longer ago, you know, closer to its release, or just shortly, not too far thereafter. So I kind of felt in this weird position where I was like one of the only people who was interested in Crime Wave in the world. like in terms of like being a film scholar and, you know, somebody who might write or, you know, papers about it. And I actually, Bart Beattie, who's one of the co-editors of the series, was on my thesis defense committee at the University of Calgary. And I had, after I defended my PhD thesis, I broached with him. I knew he had done this, started doing this series of books. And I told him, you know, you should get somebody to do a book on crime life. And he kind of brushed me off like, yeah, whatever. But then a couple of years later, they came back to me about that idea, saying, you know, not only are we interested maybe in a book on crime wave, but you should, you know, think about writing it. And so I kind of jumped at that opportunity just because, I mean, I still had to write the book and get it through a peer review process and everything. So it wasn't, you know, kind of a done deal or it by any means. But I was very kind of interested in writing about it just because, one, I loved the film and just thought it was doing some really fascinating things. But two, I felt almost like so little had been done and written about the film that it almost needed, I felt, some sort of radical redress. Like, I kind of felt like, well, the perfect revenge for this film would be for somebody to sort of, for it to go suddenly from being an almost unwritten about film to having this, you know, the longest book in the entire series written about it. And this kind of weird, extensive look. So that's one of the reasons I kind of have this bizarre, kind of almost insanely close attention paid to the film. Almost this sort of radical redress for its neglect when it's, you know, still, I think, one of the best films ever made in this country. And certainly one of the funniest.
Just to put this out there, I absolutely loved your book. Oh. It was great, a terrific read. Definitely not a light read. I think you warned me beforehand that it wasn't, you know, something that you know, and just kind of pick up and flip through and pick out your favorite stories and just kind of go from there. But so well written, so well researched, and I love the close reading of not only the film itself, but the, you know, the original ending, and then even going into the Three Worlds of Nick and the Obsession of Billy Botsky. So getting that whole career of John Pays and going into what makes Crime Wave the movie that it is, absolutely fascinating stuff.
Oh, well, thanks. I'm really glad to hear that. You know, I kind of went on to this book with the idea that, you know, well, so little had been written about Pays. That one, I didn't really have a lot of stuff to draw on in the sense of published materials. So I felt, you know, I've got to do a fair bit of kind of original looking at this thing. Although I did try to kind of draw on basically everything that had been published about it. But then, two, I kind of felt like maybe there'll never be anything written about Pays again. So, you know, unless I kind of, so I'll just shove everything into this book. And so I was very thrilled with the press to kind of allow me to make the book. The book is much longer than it's allowed to be according to the press guidelines for this series. It's longer than the book on Denis Arcand's two films. But they did, you know, they never really grumbled about it, and they were really great. I'm thrilled to hear that because I felt like I was trying to do a bit of a weird balancing act. Like I say, pushing all these sort of different things in, but it really felt like they kind of needed to be there, you know? Like, that whole original ending of the film is interesting in itself. The sort of story of it is interesting. The sort of weird way that Pays decided to do this new ending and the reasons why are, to me, just fascinating on so many levels. And also those Three Worlds of Nick films and the Billy Botsky film, where he's also got this silent, this kind of quiet man figure that he has in Crime Wave. It just really felt to me, watching all those films again, that they were somehow of a piece, you know, that it was, I think, really hard. I didn't think I could really talk about Crime Wave fully without kind of addressing those other films. And I was worried, you know, about burning people out about it. Because those films are even harder to find in some ways than Crime Wave. People who have seen this film often haven't seen, except for Springtime in Greenland, like those other Quiet Man films. But they are really a fascinating sort of thing to look at as a group. And really those films, which I presume you've managed to see them, because I think I heard you talking about them in your other broadcast. I mean, they're weirdly fascinating little pieces. And you've got, you know, cameos by Guy Madden and them and stuff. They've got all this sort of weird interest.
You mentioned a couple of the other films that are covered in the series. What are some of the other things that are in this book series?
It's a great little book series. The University of Toronto Press does it. It's called the Cinema Canada, or sorry, Canadian Cinema Series. This is the 11th book. Let me just open it up and look at it for you. But the other ones are, the first one is Bard Beattie. They did a history of violence. They've had a kind of weird, eclectic group. And again, they're all these sort of classic Canadian films. There's a history of violence by Cronenberg, the decline of the American Empire and the barbarian invasions by Denis Arcand. They did Adam McGoin's The Adjuster, The Far Shore by Joyce Wheatland, A Married Couple by Alan King, My Winnipeg by Guy Maddin is one of my favorite ones that they've done. A guy named Darren Werschler, who's a fascinating writer, did that one. Hardcore Logo, Bruce McDonald. Going Down the Road by Don Shabib. Passage by John Walker. They did Ginger Snaps by John Fawcett. I can't remember what they've got on the list coming up, but I know I'm reading the Ginger Snaps one right now, and I've read basically all the other ones at this point. But yeah, it's great, though. Weird, brilliant little series. The My Winnipeg book is really excellent, like I say. I think I remember talking to Guy and George about it at one point, and they were both very pleased with it, how it had turned out.
One of the things that I enjoyed that it's almost a necessary thing in any sort of Canadian study that I read, and I think you handled it very well as far as looking at Crime Wave as a very uniquely Canadian film and the way that Canada shapes the narrative. And I really appreciated the way that you were able to kind of work that in, really give it a good discussion, and not beat us over the head with it.
Oh, I'm glad. Yeah, it's a weird sort of thing in Canadian cinema. It almost inevitably comes back to the difference, to our relationship with the U.S. and to, Canada cinema's kind of strained and awkward relationship with U.S. cinema. Because throughout our history, there's been this tendency, and it's certainly this perception amongst filmmakers that, we are either copying Americans or not drawing enough influence from Americans. There seems to be a sort of, strange anxiety of influence in terms of like Canada's relationship to the U.S. And some people think that is fundamentally problematic in the sense that we should just fully depart from. That's in some ways what the National Film Board was an attempt to do, was start to move away fundamentally from the kind of things they were doing in Hollywood and develop a different sort of film culture. And then then sort of reaction against that in some ways were people like Pays, who wanted to, have and showcase this American influence. But at the same time, I think there's a kind of anxiety about that that kind of comes into Crime Wave in a fascinating sort of way. And it's got all these just interesting plot, aspects, that idea. Like in the film, we get almost this reverse trip into Kansas, instead of, rather than fleeing Kansas, and it's this weird toxic landscape full of billboards. Like, you almost get this sort of, impression of the U.S. as a sort of bizarre paranoiac dream that, some Canadian might stereotypically have. It's a very kind of interesting and weird kind of critique of Canadian critiques of the U.S. That I think Pays is really brilliantly sort of, and finally kind of paying off. But even if you're not, sort of inside that Canadian, imagination in a sense, I think there's a way to, just sort of get all, it just comes across as very funny and strange and fascinating in a way.
Well, for a movie that I've seen probably, 100 times at least, you managed to really open my eyes to a lot of things that I hadn't thought about before, especially this whole idea of the trip into Kansas and the Dr. Jolly character as being this, almost wizard in reverse, granting Stephen Penny this power, but also being a madman at the same time.
Yeah, that specific idea is not original to me. I think it's Prevere's idea, but I forget who I'm kind of quoting from. But I sort of developed it a bit further. There's very few things that have been written about this film, like I say, but they're very good. And I know I know I grabbed that particular kind of Kansas idea from somebody and then started running with it in a kind of crazy way. But it's, you know, it's a fascinating, weird insight. I think, you know, so I can kind of, because it's not entirely original to me, I feel like I can bolster how, you know, how great that idea is. You know, it is kind of a weird, interesting thing. Like you say, there's a strange kind of way of looking at the film that, even especially in terms of its technicolor kind of aping, it makes it kind of interesting compared to, you know, that sort of Oz narrative. There's all sorts of fascinating things. Like, I've probably watched it as, you know, maybe more than anybody in the world at this point, other than maybe Pays, or possibly you. It sounds like you've, you know, gone through it pretty extensively. But yeah, like even when I watched it again, like when we did a release of this book in Winnipeg, the film group screened the film again, and even I was noticing, you know, more things that, you know, Pays just packed it so tightly with all this amazing sort of stuff.
The other thing that I never really thought of was the way that the, you know, Neil Lowry as Dr. Jolly can kind of play into him as the Hank Williams impersonator too. And just the way that you kind of tie those threads together also, I found to be very enjoyable to read that.
It's interesting because, you know, that kind of thing is, I think, as I mentioned in the book, like it's a sort of standard thing that you see in those kinds of cash-strapped productions where everyone just has to do a different, you know, role. You know, you just got so many people around, they got to put on a new hat. But Pace has this weird way of just, he gives them the same hat, and he makes it really strangely clear. And because Crime Wave has that metafictional structure, you know, he just seems to be, he just is layering in all these weird sort of connected parts, and there's all sorts of strange ways to interpret it. Like, he just, Pace is a very shy, sort of soft-spoken guy, but he has a sort of masterful command of this stuff. Like, it just seems to just intuitively and, you know, very clinically, almost in a sense, just have a knowledge of how to do the best thing. Like, even in ways, and it kind of becomes a strange little puzzle in a sense, although at the same time, just, you know, it's kind of, you know, straightforwardly funny and, you know, very engaging, and doesn't have a hermetic kind of quality that you sometimes get with those types of films. It's, you know, yeah, he's doing a lot of really weird, fascinating things. But I think just the structure of the film, like the fact that it is a sort of self-reflexive thing, it just kind of amps up any, even potentially accidental sort of connectedness.
Right, yeah. It's not like this film is one of these movies where you're just like, oh, wow, there's got to be a whole lot of other things that I'm not picking up on when you watch it the first time. It's like, not like, I don't know, this thing where it's like, you know, watching certain movies and you're just like, okay, I think I understand what's going on, but I know that there's a whole lot more under the surface. Instead, you're just having a great time, and then as you watch it more, you pick up a little bit more. But to read what you have done with it, and just the way that you have done this close reading, it really, like I said, it opened up my eyes to a whole lot of other things where I was just like, oh yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And with Pays being that kind of, you know, very, very smart man, you know, I've had conversations with him before, and he is just such a pleasure to talk to, and so knowledgeable about film and the craft and everything, that it seems like he's one of these guys where it's like, yeah, there's probably not a whole lot of accidental stuff in here.
No, he's got it, you know, he's got it in his head, and, you know, has this kind of precise vision. But as you say, I mean, it's never mystifying. It's never, you know, like the Donnie Darko situation of, you're not really sure. It's enjoyable and you're interested, but you're not really sure what went on. You know, and there's this kind of puzzling quality. It's not that at all, but it does have all these layers that, you know, you can just keep, you know, peeling off. Even although you can just ignore it also and just kind of enjoy the film, it's got a very fascinating sort of, it's just a consummate craftsman in that sense, even though he's doing some very strange things that you really think shouldn't work. Like, really, in many respects, to just describe the film blankly, it almost makes, you know, it sounds like a fun little, almost 8.5 parody, but it's not like that at all. You know, it's some sort of strange, bizarre, you know, very funny, very kind of engaging and silly and, you know, even cute and, you know, kind of, you know, heartwarming in places, with, you know, this wonderful little Kim, Eva Kovacs, and there's all sorts of great, strange, just watchable, just really fun, engaging, and it holds up in so many ways. For, you know, a completely cast-strapped, you know, bootstrap production made, like you say, you know, in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of Canada, at a time when really nobody's doing this sort of a thing. Nobody. Like, is even some of the things that, you know, are going to come in with Lynch, you know, Pays has sort of anticipated particular things that are going to crop up in Lynch and Pee-wee's Big Adventure and so on. He's doing it just a little earlier in those Quiet Man films, and then kind of perfecting them in a way with this Crime Wave, which is coming out right around the time of those films.
And I love the way that he's playing with the medium as well, and just using that lower budget to really create his creativity, to make him face these challenges. And that's what I enjoyed about your book as well, was not only am I getting this reading of the film and everything, but you're telling me a lot of the behind-the-scenes stuff, like the whole idea of the streetlight that, mm-hmm. not the one that falls on his head, but the one that we see flickering to life. I never in a million years did not think that that was a real streetlight.
No, neither did I. I mean, one of the great... I couldn't really have done this book without the participation of someone, of Pace himself, so I was really thrilled. My big fear when I kind of settled on writing this book was that Pace wouldn't participate, or wouldn't be... Because he has a strange reputation, for whatever reason, as being a sort of, you know, somebody who's very unwilling to talk to, you know, interviewers, or, you know, wants to exert a very kind of amount of control over things. But, I mean, I never once had any problem at all with him being weird or not forthcoming. You know, if anything, you know, I made sort of mild tentative moves towards him, and he was, you know, very gracious. He sent me copies of the copy of the film with the original ending to watch. He sent me the, you know, copies of the scripts to read. He answered every question I asked him, and, you know, told me about that streetlight. I mean, all sorts of. He was extremely, you know, forthcoming and helpful, and really just, you know, the book really wouldn't be what it is without his participation, for sure.
I was tickled pink, but also a little saddened by the story that you tell in the intro to the book about your friend who really doesn't even believe that the film exists.
No, that's a true story. Like, it sounds kind of made up, but when I was telling her about this book I was going to write, and, you know, thinking of doing it, I was kind of, these are the ideas that I'm kind of, this is what the film's about, and she just wouldn't believe me. She looked it up on Wikipedia, and, you know, thought it sounds so absurd to her that she just really refused to believe it existed. There's so little information about it out in the world that she thought I had faked it and it was a hoax. And of course, because I'm kind of known, again, like, for writing this kind of experimental fiction and stuff, it was a plausible sort of hoax that I would have done this. In fact, I was kind of working on a novel at the time that had a very similar conceit in some ways, and there's actually been a couple Canadian novels where, you know, Michael Turner wrote a novel called American Whiskey Bar that was about a sort of fictitious film and describing it and so on. And, you know, nevertheless, you know, of course, the film is real. And, you know, she, I think, now believes me. I did send her a copy of the book, but she hasn't confirmed that she's actually, you know, believes it exists still or not. There's a glockenspiel-based score that really got her. Like, there's some line on Wikipedia about the flute and glockenspiel based score, and she thought, well, that just can't be true. But, you know, I assured her that it was.
When it comes to the top, why do so few guys make it?
That's a good question. You know, I think they just can't take the idea to the end. You know, I do a lot of, like I say, teaching in creative writing, and, you know, again, I'm kind of like literary and, you know, film scholar, and the sort of, I'm kind of a constant critic, I guess you'd say, in a sense. And the thing that I notice a lot of, and what really frustrates me about a lot of work that people, that artists make, is that they tend to sort of have an idea that's brilliant, and they'll run with that idea, but they won't go to the end of the idea. And that was always, in some ways, my criticism of the original ending of Crime Wave, when I do kind of discuss it. My sort of position on it is that, you know, it has these kind of interesting qualities, but it doesn't really go it doesn't really follow the logic that's been established, and it doesn't take it to its extreme ends. Whereas the reshot ending that pays, you know, did append finally on the crime wave, it does that. You know, it just takes his sort of initial core kind of brilliant idea, and it really takes it to its extreme sort of final position. I find that a lot of artists stop for some reason, whether because the market seems to demand it, or because they have some particular fear, or they simply have an inability to just take that thing that they're doing all the way to its sort of end point. But I think Repays really kind of, you know, did that and really sort of took, you know, this germ that was Crime Wave and kind of really developed it as far as it would go. And really, if you kind of go backwards to The Quiet Man, when it crops up in Billy Bosky there, he kind of just, from that point, moves through the Three Wolves of Nick, and then he reaches Crime Wave, and he just takes that idea pretty much to its absolute extreme terminus. The sort of unfortunate side of that is then he quits and stops making those films. But he does, in some ways, you know, to talk to him, certainly, you know, he didn't feel there was another place to take the idea. And I, you know, the more I mean, it often gets framed in some ways that there's this tragic story and Pays, you know, like Stephen Penny, kind of met with this block that he couldn't move past. While I see that as sort of, you know, what the film is about on a fundamental level, I don't think it's really necessarily true of Pays. And I think Crime Wave is that sort of, you know, perfect ending of this, you know, development. Whereas other people, like say, don't really get to that top. But once you're at the top, I mean, there's only one place to go, which is down. So I think Pays, you know, much as I would like to see him make more films like this, I think he was kind of wise in some ways to just stop what he was doing and either, you know, start a new thing, which, you know, he's kind of done as a director for hire.
Yeah, which, you know, is always interesting to look at what he's done as a director for hire. Sometimes you see what he, you know, you see Pays within that. Sometimes you don't. I mean, seeing, Top of the Food Chain to me is, I won't say it's equally as brilliant, but there are so many amazing parts of that. And as a whole, it is just a terrific film. And that's one of those, like, since it's a lot easier to find, I tend to recommend that to people just so they can see some of Pays's work.
Yeah, Top of the Food Chain is really great. And I kind of briefly, I think, have about a paragraph on it. But at that point, I really just felt, you know, I've got too much stuff in this book. So they're going to start telling me to rip things out of it. So I didn't really get too far into that work. I agree with you. Top of the Food Chain is a great film. And absolutely, you know, worthy of people watching it. And like you say, it's much, much easier to find. Unfortunately, I mean, it's, you know, it'd be nice if Crime Wave was more available. I'm really hoping it becomes more available. There's some possibility for that, given that the film has, again, changed hands through an accidental sort of transfer where one company is bought by another. So we'll see, you know, but there's a possibility, I guess, of some, you know, new life for it. Unfortunately, you know, there's a kind of long-term contract that was initially signed, and it has really sort of awkward parts to it, I suppose. But, and, you know, people just aren't necessarily interested in releasing a film that was never a huge hit. You know, all the technology is changing. It's in some ways become easier to do those sorts of releases. So I'm really, you know, crossing my fingers for a new kind of availability for this film. I certainly, the book, my dream is that the book will help spur that sort of thing forward. That was one of the big reasons, to get back to your earlier question, one of the big reasons I did this book was just to try to help get Crime Wave re-released. You know, if there's a book about it, maybe, you know, there's some sort of cultural interest in it that the book can maybe attest to that might spur forth a kind of re-release. So, you know, hopefully that's going to help Pays make that case.
Do you think you can shame the world into bringing Crime Wave out?
I sure hope so. I don't know. but it's such a amazing, I mean, the fact that it's been so durable and still it's on people's radar, you know, all this time later. I mean, it's almost 30 years later at this point. You know, here we are talking about it, And there's a book about it, and, you know, it's really still chugging forth at a slow and steady pace.
So the book comes out early 2014, and almost right out of the gate, you get interviewed by Eva Kovacs.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like to be interviewed by the person who's narrating, half narrating, the story of Crime Wave for you, the writer of the book of Crime Wave?
Yeah, I mean, it was beyond strange, but somehow very, you know, I mean, Eva Kovacs became a news anchor in town. I knew she was a news anchor in this city. She actually, when I started, was writing the book at one point, had retired, or, you know, from being a morning news anchor. And so at one earlier draft of the book, you know, it mentions that she's, you know, no longer on TV. And then as I was revising the book, she got back on TV at another station, if I remember right. So I, you know, changed it to reflect that. And so it's technically up to date. But I mean, I knew she was out there. I knew there was the possibility of being, like, interviewed by her for a show. But, I, you know, it's a weird academic book about a film almost nobody has watched. So I didn't, you know, really expect that to happen. So it was just great that the book got a surprising amount of press when it was released. And certainly, you know, of course she's interested in it. But it was very strange. They were showing clips of it on TV, and, you know, it was very surreal for me. Somebody who, you know, wasn't even, I mean, I was, what, 5 or 6 years old when this film came out, younger than her. So it was very kind of surreal to be, you know, looking in live in the flesh, this, you know, little girl that I've been studying under a microscope almost. It felt very strange, but, you know, it was very kind of, you know, she was so enthusiastic and, you know, very kind of childlike even in her sort of, you know, joy that this film was getting some attention again. It was so, and actually, funnily, like my friend who you know, didn't really believe the film existed, her coworkers didn't really believe that she had been in the movie because it wasn't really available. She hadn't really talked about it a lot because it wasn't available. And, you know, so she has, you know, the proof finally, I suppose.
So how many times as you're telling people, oh, yeah, I'm working on this book about Crime Wave, how many times do people go, oh, the Sam Raimi film?
Yeah. You know, I got that a couple of times, but because I was mostly working on it when I was in Winnipeg, you know, people, you know, knew what I was talking about, even if they hadn't seen it. So I got a lot less than you expect, but just because I was in Winnipeg, you know. Yeah, people think of the Sam Raimi film, which, you know, came out the same year. I mean, what terrible luck. This thing has just been plagued by the worst luck in so many ways in terms of its releasing. But, I mean, it's still out there and still kind of persisting. So I think it'll have the last laugh.
You talked about talking to Pays for this book. Who else did you have to talk to or interview for this one?
You know, I talked to a bunch of people kind of, again, who were kind of connected to the city around town. But what I found for the most part was the stuff that Pays was telling me was the most usable, just because it kind of really clearly connected to what I was writing about. But one of the people who's really helpful was Dave Barber, who runs the Cinematheque, which is, you know, part of the Winnipeg Film Group here. They're sort of, you know, film, movie theater. And, you know, Barbara remembered, of course, you know, when Pays was working on this film and some of the first screenings. And Barbara was the one, if I remember, who actually told me about the alternative ending that Pays had had previously on the film. He was the first person to sort of bring that to my attention. So I don't know if I even would have pursued that as aggressively as I had, like trying to get a copy of that and do a chapter on it, if Barbara hadn't really convinced me, you know, somebody needed to do that. He was kind of talking more about it'd be great if somebody could do a DVD release, put this original ending on, so people could watch it and everything. But, you know, this is almost kind of the closest thing it's gotten to a DVD release, me describing what it looks like and everything that happens in it, I guess. So, you know, there are a lot of people who are really helpful, but Barbara was particularly helpful. And, of course, you know, Guy was very gracious to, you know, not just talk to me a little bit about the film, but which he wasn't, you know, super involved in, but more so that, you know, to give me, you know, a blurb for the back of the book and say something nice about Pays in the film, which was a big influence on him at one point. Pace is really an influence on a lot of those figures, but certainly, Guy is the most well-known of the people who are directly influenced by him.
You mentioned a little bit as far as what you're working on now with the poetry and all that.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on with the book? Are you doing like readings or like touring it around, or what's happening with that?
All that's a bit of a standstill right now, because there's some sort of, developments for the fall. The press has sort of decided to do this. All the books out and available and people can buy it. They're going to kind of relaunch it in a sense in the fall. There's all sorts of sort of stuff that is in motion, I guess, to try to get some more attention to the book and the film. But I that stuff hasn't been 100% confirmed to me yet. But it's looking good for some sort of thing to happen around the Toronto Film Festival related to the book and the film. But I don't know for sure what the news is on that. So
understandable. So hey, where's the best place for folks to catch up with you and to purchase a copy of Crime Wave?
Well, Crime Wave is pretty much available, I guess you'd say, anywhere. I've got it. And my website is just jonathanball.com. So I'm JonathanBall.com. But otherwise, it's on Amazon. I like to buy things from McNally Robinson, the local independent Winnipeg bookstore that's also online. But it's really, pretty easily available. University of Toronto Press has really great distribution. They're a big press. So, you wouldn't have a hard time finding it anywhere. You might have to order it, but you could certainly get it pretty much through any bookstore at all.
Adios, amigo.